watch. So like, this is the weirdest thing I've ever said on YouTube. If you handshake with someone, in the next 10 seconds, you will touch your own nose because you're trying to smell their hand.
It is Vanessa Van Edwards.
She's a human lie detector.
She is the founder and lead investigator at the Science of People.
The woman who used to hide in the bathroom to avoid people at parties and is now the most captivating person in most any room.
Believing you can't succeed in love, life, or business without first mastering people.
It's almost impossible to be charismatic when you're feeling afraid. It comes from a study. They split them up into two different groups. The second group, they had them wear sweat pads and skydive. People who smelled the fear sweat pads, their own fear part of their amygdala lit up. Their brain could smell that fear sweat and they began to feel afraid. This is a study that changed my life, okay? Hey,
let's dig in. Vanessa.
And a cold brew and everything.
And a cold brew,
thank
yes.
you.
Starbucks, you should definitely be paying us. Come
yes.
on. Every interview I do is a Starbucks logo in
it's
it.
Very clever, by the way, because to start an interview with here's your cold brew is basically saying this is going to be good.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. You're nice and cold out now. I love it. So, Vanessa.
Yes.
This is actually the third time you've been on the show.
Can you believe it?
And I mean,
I love our interviews so much. When
I
you
do
reached
as well.
Out, I was like, yes,
yes,
let's do it again.
Yes. And one of the things we wanted to talk about was something that was different.
Yes.
And one thing that has changed is that you've had a second child now.
I have, yes.
Claire.
Yes.
And I'm sure Sienna is a very
vivacious
great sister.
5-year-old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, one of the things I want to talk about, because I actually just visited back home to see my brother, and mm-hmm. the way he's communicating now mm-hmm. is definitely changed. He's more patient. He's a better listener. Mm-hmm. What are the things that you've learned? I know this is your second child, but
yeah.
I'm sure you get reminded about
oh,
these
more.
Experiences.
Oh, yeah. Second kid is more because everything that you thought was a fluke the first time is real.
Really?
Yeah, because it confirms it. So one thing that I think about a lot, and this is, I think, helpful for everyone, whether you're a parent or not, is how we form our communication styles. Right. So as adults, we have communication styles, ways that we communicate on text or email, like even down to how we use exclamation points. So, Sean, are you an exclamation point user or no?
Depends on the person.
Okay.
I know one of the conversations you said we have to adjust based
yes.
on who we're talking
yes,
to.
Yes, yes.
So I do adjust sometimes, but I would say mostly not.
Okay.
Mostly
so
not.
I
yeah.
think, and anyone who's watching this,
yeah.
for highly competent folks, folks who lean higher on the competent scale, which they're competent communicators, it is physically painful for them to add exclamation points. Like they are like, it sounds like I'm yelling. It's too enthusiastic.
Right.
Whereas highly warm communicators, they love an exclamation point. They have an exclamation point after every sentence, right? Mm. They love emojis. They love words like wow, yay, whoop, fab, okay?
Right.
So that even just down to our way we communicate, there's different styles. So we actually form our communication styles starting around age 3.
Oh,
this is amazing to think about. So there was research that was done, incredible amount of data, where they had 3-year-olds come into their lab, not really, really their caregivers,
yeah.
and they asked caregivers to rate their child personality on a number of different traits. And so the caregivers filled out this huge survey of their children, everything from agreeableness to extroversion to organization to conscientiousness, all the personality traits. Then they followed these children for 25 years.
Wow, it's a long okay? study.
It's okay. a really long study. And when they went back to these kids, now adults at 27, 28, they had them do the same test for themselves. And what they found were the results were shockingly similar. The way that caregivers described them at age 3 was shockingly similar to the way that they described themselves at age 28.
Interesting.
So what I think about is, okay, if our personality, our communication style is nature or nurture, right? 3 is not birth,
right?
Right? Can we change it, right? If we have a communication style that isn't working for us, can we change it if it's been ingrained in us from 3? And then second, what can we learn about ourselves? And also, how can we help our children develop communication styles that really work for them. So as I have a second, I'm seeing how different they are. Same parents, same home, same city, and they are radically different. And so I've been thinking a lot about how our communication styles grow.
And it's not about the lifestyle, right? Because you guys are the same parents. You're treating them the same values.
Yes.
It's really just the fact
same
that they're
bedroom.
Different.
Same bedroom. Like we moved my daughter out of her bedroom so that we could have the baby. So same right. crib, same right. chair, same, and still radically different. Now she's only 8 months old, sure. but I'm already seeing the differences. And so I think, you know, one thing that people could think about is what forces shaped your personality. So was that genetics? Could be. You know, is it the way your parents parented you? Is there things along the way that shape the way that you communicate? I think that those are interesting things to think about when we're talking about, you know, how we relate to others.
Right. So are you adjusting based on that now that you have observed it to treat them differently? Or should you? Like, is that the way it should be done for parents that are seeing such vast different personalities amongst babies?
Yes, with an exclamation point. I like exclamation points.
Yes.
I even verbally add exclamation points. That's how much I like them. Okay, so here's my approach, especially now that I'm a parent, I really think this. So I was taught the golden rule growing up. You know, the golden rule, treat others as you would like to be treated, right? That was what I was taught. And I think that that is a fundamentally flawed way of looking at life. And so I am not parenting with the golden rule. And I actually don't teach the golden rule. Every one of my students knows I'm much more for the platinum rule. The platinum rule, you know, platinum, by the way, the play here is that platinum is more precious than gold.
Yes.
Okay. And the platinum rule is that you should treat others as they would want to be treated. And I think this is a really important thing to think about is let's just take conscientiousness, right? Conscientiousness is an aspect of our personality. There's five aspects of our personality. You know them as ocean, openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism.
Okay.
And I love talking about neuroticism.
And it was always the one that I don't know about.
But let's talk about that one because that's the biggest difference between my kids because I have a high neurotic and a low neurotic.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So let's do neuroticism. So neuroticism is our emotional stability. High neurotics are reactive to their environment. They have a lot less internal emotional stability. They are worriers typically. They actually feel negative experiences more strongly. Most people think neuroticism is a choice, but actually it is a chemical difference in how we process. People who are high neuroticism, this is me. Yeah. We carry long forms of a certain gene called the serotonin transporter gene. This gene means that high neurotics produce less serotonin more slowly. So what happens to a high neurotic is I'm in the car. My husband's a low neurotic. I'm a high neurotic. That pairing goes really well, by the way.
Is that a formula?
It can be really helpful have like opposites to help each other in a lot of ways because there are strengths and weaknesses to both, which we'll talk about both.
Please, yeah.
We're in the car. Someone almost hits us, okay? We go, at the same time, both my husband and I, our cortisol begins to flow and we're like, whew, that was close. But as a high neurotic, the serotonin, which is helps calm you down or it helps you feel okay, it's kind of a sense of belonging, is slower. So my husband, immediately everything's okay. His body produces serotonin and he's forgot about that little accident within a couple of minutes. Me, I'm still in cortisol. Even 20 minutes later, I'm a little bit jumpy. And that is because my body produces less serotonin more slowly, meaning I feel negative experiences more strongly. That is why worriers worry. They are literally worriers because it hurts them more when something bad happens.
Right.
Whereas a low neurotic is like, it's no big deal. If something goes wrong, we'll deal with it because they can recover so quickly. So there are benefits, pros and cons. Low neurotics are emotionally stable. They are very calm. They can usually control their inner experience. They are great in a crisis, right? They are the rock who gets you through. They are very level-headed. They can keep you calm. They can stay calm. They're the people you want next to you if something's going wrong.
Sure.
High neurotics prevent crises from happening in the first place.
Right.
High neurotics totally are like, that. We don't want a crisis to happen.
Right.
So we're going to get all the emergency gear. We're going to have plans B, C, D, and E, right? So both are incredibly important.
You need both.
You need to have both.
Yes.
Right. So Knowing that, I see I have a high neurotic daughter, and I believe my little is a low neurotic. Already, I can see this. And so for my high neurotic, I know that she experiences negative experiences more strongly. So if I'm a high neurotic, I'm going to treat her with more care in that way. Mm. I'm going to tell her the plan ahead of time. I'm going to tell her the backup plan. Whereas my little one, I let her do things that I never let my first child do, because I'm like, she'll be all right.
Sure.
So I'm trying to treat them as they should be treated, as opposed to how I would treat them.
Right.
And that's how I approach all relationships.
Right, right. And it's something that people don't really think about, right? Mm-hmm. I would imagine if you're not aware of that, the person that has low neuroticism would be like, oh, this person is way too reactive. Calm down.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
And vice versa. I'm sure the other person is like, why are you so calm all the time? Like,
you're not being proactive.
Are you a robot? Like, you know, do you have any emotions? It's certainly a barrier.
Yes. And so this is, I think, something that is, when we know it, it frees us, right? So one is, think about the 3 to 5 most important people in your life. Are they high, medium, or low? It can be high. It's a scale. Right. So high, medium, or low. For your high neurotics in your life, a gift you can give them is knowing their worry triggers. Right? What triggers their worry? Like for me, my husband knows that not having a plan kind of triggers my worry. So he's really good at trying to get a plan for me.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
He would never do a surprise party for me. Right? He would know that would not make me happy. Yeah. So what are their worry triggers? And second, how do they worry? Are they verbalizers? Or are they closed downers, shutter inners, right? So there are two different kinds of worry. So extroverts typically verbalize their worry. They want to talk it out. And they don't want you to solve it, right? They verbalize it until they're like, done, empty. Then you have high neurotics who usually introverts are, they shut down. They want to retreat. They want to be alone. They want to process. They want to think. They do not want to be talked to, bothered, touched, anything. They need a process before they can even begin to talk about it. It is a gift to allow your worrier to worry as they naturally worry. If you try to pry out an introvert, they feel very violated and unsupported. Right. All you're doing is trying to understand, but they're not ready yet.
They might even go further down the rabbit hole of
and push you away.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Whereas a high neurotic, if you try to shut down their verbalizing, they will not stop worrying. Right? They feel super unheard. And so it's a gift to give them that, treat them as they want to be treated. If you are a high neurotic and you have a low neurotic in your life, it's very important to understand that they do not understand how you experience bad things. So when they say, don't worry, they don't mean it in a mean way.
Right.
They really don't. They really think they're trying to be helpful.
Right, right.
They also are going to say things like calm down.
I was just going to say that. I was like, do not use that word.
Do not
use those two words.
The word, like, right? What is the famous phrase? Never in the history of calm down has calm down ever calmed anyone down.
So
that
true.
Is the way it works.
So true.
So we should try to avoid that. But when they do say something like calm down or no worries, they really are coming from a good place. The last thing you want to do is react at them. Right? They're lost. They're like, what is happening? Because they don't experience negative experiences like you do.
Yep.
And so the best thing you can do is when you're calm is try to explain your triggers to them and how you like to worry.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's just one of the personality traits, but yeah.
For sure. I mean, just the fact that you're aware of that, I think is good, because I think people just judge the other person without really understanding the fact that we're just wired differently.
Literally, right? Physiologically differently.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. And like, I think that's, you know, we talk a lot about accepting difference. That is one of the ways we can accept difference,
sure.
Right? Is understanding how we're wired differently and understanding someone's personality traits and willing to adjust your communication style to match theirs.
Got it. Yeah. So this is the first thing that has changed since our last conversation. Oh, yeah. It's a big change, obviously.
Yeah.
The second change that's happened is this rise of AI.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Let's talk about AI. Yes.
Some really interesting stuff, some really scary stuff. I don't know if you've ever seen deepfake interviews that are being done. One example is like Joe Rogan interviewing Steve Jobs or Sam Altman, who's the founder of OpenAI. And I like, it gets me thinking, because if someone never heard of this interview or Joe Rogan, you would almost think that they're actually having a real life conversation. And I don't know if you've gotten to that point where like someone has deepfaked your speaking reels. You've done it yourself?
I did it to myself.
Okay. So this is my question is, What is it that is the essence of the way humans communicate that even AI today won't really be able to replicate? Like, what is the thing where if you heard an AI speak versus a human speak, what is the difference that like, no, this, because of this, this is the real Vanessa Van Edwards or the real Joe Rogan? How do we tell those apart?
I think the only way right now, and this could change in a couple of years, but right now, and I created deep fakes of myself to see how it would go.
Oh, so interesting.
Right? Yeah. It did not get right, not even close. Intonation and emphasis, vocal power. It was really interesting because we uploaded my audiobooks. So that's, you know, 12 hours of me speaking. We uploaded podcasts where I was speaking conversationally. So it had dozens of hours of me speaking and it did not get the intonation right. It was my voice.
Yeah.
But I'll give you an example. So I have a certain kind of cadence that I speak with. I'll emphasize different parts of a sentence. My deep fake would emphasize the wrong things.
Oh, interesting.
And so at the end of a sentence, it would do differently. It would sound different than how I actually sound. I would never talk like that, but it would make it. So the emphasis was so wrong that you knew it wasn't correct and it wasn't helpful. Right. Like I emphasize words based on what I think is helpful to the listener, right? So like when we talk about neuroticism, I emphasize neuroticism because it's a hard word. I slow it down and I want you to hear it. The AI doesn't know that's a hard word.
Yeah.
So it's not going to add emphasis or more eloquence to that word to help the listener understand. Whereas I am thinking very quickly, what's the most important word in this sentence?
Right.
What's a word that someone's going to be hard to understand? So they didn't get that right. However, I think there's a lot of opportunity and I am not that scared. Mostly because I don't think it's helpful to me, but also because I think there's some things that I literally don't have time to do that AI can do for me.
Sure.
For example, people have asked us, hey, I would love to have an option on your website where I could listen to your articles. Well, the only way to do that before was having like a really awful AI voice be like, confidence strategies. So now we can turn on my voice. So people can listen to something kind of like me for the articles. I could never have time to read all 700 articles on my website, but at least my voice can kind of do it. It's better than having a random AI voice do it.
Sure.
I also think that people aren't thinking about AI in terms of communication and relationships. So I'm working on a LinkedIn learning course right now on AI for communication.
Oh, how did that work?
So we're drafting it right now. I'm really excited about it because most people think of AI in terms of like productivity. You know, getting things done, being more efficient. But I'm like, oh, no. AI has, it's the shortcut into more charisma. So right now, if you want to write a charismatic email, for example, it's hard, right? You have to think, you know, the definition of charisma from the research is a combination of high warmth and high competence. Most of our emails that we write nowadays are very sterile. They lack no warmth and no competence because we're in a rush. We write 1,000 emails a day and it's hard to write warmth and competent emails. So first we have to make our emails not sterile. That's hard. Then we have to make them the perfect balance of warm and competent. Warm is words that inspire connection. Happy, best, both, collaborate, connect. Emojis, exclamation points, words like yay, way, yay, fab, whoop,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Competent is words that make you want to get things done. Power, efficient, brainstorm. Right. Lead, streamline, efficient numbers, graphs, charts, percents, dollar signs. Those are all competent.
Right.
So trying to sift through all the words and replace them and not make it too long, that is a lot of brain power. Now, you are already charismatic. So you have to work to get yourself into this email. Who's got time for that?
Sure. Right? And most people are one or the other, right? If they aren't actively thinking about
most of us have an imbalance. So a highly warm person really struggles to add competence that feels authentic. And a highly competent person really struggles to add warmth that feels authentic. Well, now that we have AI, you can write a bare bones email and you can tell it if you know what to tell it. Hey, can you make this both warm, friendly, and likable? As well as competent, powerful, and efficient. And within 10 seconds, you have a very charismatic draft for you to edit. That is efficient charisma.
Sure.
And so I think there's so much wonderful potential there in terms of using it to communicate better.
So when you're spitting that out into the AI model, break that down. So assuming most people are having in-person conversations,
yes,
and they can't use AI to have these conversations just yet.
Yes.
You never know what's going to happen.
Yes.
What is actually happening that allows you to have that warmth of communication, mm-hmm. but also show competence in an in-person conversation? Yes.
Well, first of all, a lot of my students, I ask them to write first because it trains you. So whether you do that with AI or not, it's helpful to actually practice with writing first because it's very hard to do it in person. So like I think of it as like a practice stepladder. The hardest is in person. That's the last way I want you to practice, because when you're there's so many inputs happening right now that we're in person. We're making eye contact. I'm looking at your nodding, your posture, your hand gestures. I'm thinking about my posture, my hand gestures. I'm also very aware that there's cameras around. It's a lot. So to add warmth and confidence on top is too hard. So, okay, don't practice in person. Then it's the phone. No, actually, then it's video. Yeah. Video like is a little bit smaller than phone. Then chat, then text, then emails. So I actually would like you people to start actually in those steps.
Progressive.
Yeah. It does train you to use those words. So in person, if we were to skip all the way to the top, there are four ways that we send warmth and competence. Our words, that's one way. Our body language, gestures, posture, facial expressions. Our voice, our vocal power, our cadence, our volume, our tone, and our ornaments. The clothes we wear, what's in our background, our earrings, your glasses, your watch, what you're drinking, what you're holding in a profile picture, what's behind you in a profile picture, ornaments.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of options, four channels that you can choose to play with because you can add warmth and competence to any of them.
Right.
So my goal is like, okay, I want you to be authentically warm and competent. I don't want you to do something that doesn't feel natural to you. Which channel do you like the best? Which one feels the most comfortable to you? And then I'm going to give you, there are 96 cues that you can play with, like a recipe.
96.
96
crazy,
cues.
Right?
Yes, there are 96. Now, I tried to create an encyclopedia of all the cues. And there are probably more than 96, but I was able to kind of group them. Like, for example, head behavior. Just head behavior alone, there's probably 10 to 12. So there's up and down nodding. There's horizontal nodding. There's the side nodding, right? There's a head tilt. There's like fast nodding, like impatient. So but even just in that, so I try to bucket them, but you have 96 cues at your disposal to play with. And so you can choose which of those channels you want to optimize first.
Okay, I have so many questions just from that context, right? So one of the difficult things that at least I have when I enter like an in-person conversation, particularly in group settings, right? I would say, I think you're an ambivert, right?
Yeah, I'm an ambivert,
I'm similar as well. And I do need to recharge when I'm in these in-person conversations. And when I'm out of practice, right? Maybe I've been focused heads down. You know, maybe some of us have had a baby and they haven't had that experience of like getting at the rust of speaking. And I review the 96 cues. But for me, I always seem to be in my head during the conversations to know where my hands should be, to know what my tone of voice should be, to know what questions I should ask. And I often find myself not being present sometimes because of these things that I have to think about.
Yes.
Is there any things that you can do before maybe you go into a group setting that can help you get maybe a little bit less social anxiety or just help you kind of maybe even during the moment to help you actually have these conversations in a more natural way and be more present?
Yes. So there's a couple answers to this. I'll give all of them. So the first one is your chemistry. So there is a lot of research to show that if we are in a fear mode, that is very contagious. It's almost impossible to be charismatic when you're feeling afraid or anxious. And that's a big statement, I know, but it comes from a study. So they wanted to study how fear works socially.
Right.
So they brought people into their lab. They split them up into two different groups. The first group, they wore sweat pads. They're horrible sweatsuits that catch your sweat under your armpits. And they had them run on the treadmill. Sweaty, exercise, sweat.
Right.
The second group, they had them wear sweat pads and skydive for the first time. So fear-induced sweat. They took these sweat pads and they had unsuspecting participants. The participants had no idea what they were smelling. Smell these sweat pads. Now, they had no idea what they didn't even know there was sweat.
Yeah.
But they put them in an fMRI machine and they gave them to smell these sweat pads. Gross, right? people who smelled the fear sweat pads, their own fear part of their amygdala lit up. So somehow their brain could smell that fear sweat and they began to feel afraid.
Interesting.
And so this is the first of many studies that is beginning to look at the cues that we don't even know we're sending through our pheromones, maybe through our sweat, through, right? Or even like down to cues we can't control, our blink rate. You know, blink rate is a cue. I didn't talk about it in my book because you can't control it.
Right.
But higher blink rate is associated with more nervousness.
Now I'm blinking right now.
Right, you're blinking more. I know. The moment, so it was in my book and my editor and I were talking about it and I was like, you know what? I'm going to take it out because the moment someone thinks about their blink rate, they start blinking more.
I know.
It's a horrible affliction.
It's like once you see someone yawn, right? Like, oh.
Yeah, exactly. Contagious. It's like a really weird thing. So there's all these cues that we can't even control. Okay. So one is before you even show up, I think it's really important to work on your chemistry. That's twofold. Do not go to events that make you really anxious or nervous. I am a big believer in that. If there's someone that you're dreading seeing, don't see them. Cut them out of your life.
Sure. Yeah.
Right? Like I don't go. So for example, I was just at a big conference. We were talking about it. I did not go to the welcome party. The welcome party is not for me.
Yeah, me neither.
The ambiverts, I cannot do it. Loud, really big spaces. Whew, with like lots of wandering around. Not for me. I did not go to the closing party. I love the workshops. I love the books talks. I love sitting in the audience listening. I love like the sidebar conversations. So I say know that about yourself. Like don't put yourself in those situations because it's really hard to be charismatic. Second, if you have to go into one of those conversations or you're a little bit nervous, I do think that laughter is sort of like the secret key to unlocking and changing your chemistry. It releases all kinds of endorphins. It makes you feel happier. And so I have a laughter playlist that I watch on YouTube, which is a ton of funny videos.
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing when I'm putting on makeup. That's what I'm doing like before I walk into a room. I'll call a funny friend. I listen to funny podcasts. Like I think laughter, like it immediately snaps you out of it.
Right.
That's that. The second thing, so we talked about, the question was about going into an event that makes you a little bit nervous. Yeah. And if you can, try to have a wingman. Wingman or wingwoman.
Wingman always
that
helps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. One of the cues that we didn't talk about, you know, we talked a lot about like the different ornaments and the physical natures. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I was curious about is smell. And smell, as we just brought up, is the only thing that you can actually go through when you're in an in-person experience, where you're a job interview or a date or an interview like this. Mm-hmm. So talk to me a bit about smell between different genders as well. Yeah. And what are kind of, what's like a safe smell that you can use for any different scenarios that, just allows you to be.
There's so much research being done on this, which is really exciting. So there's like the pheromone side of things and the synthetic side of things. So your natural scent versus scents you can add. So one is there is somehow a scent to fear, right? Like, that's why getting your chemistry right is the most sexy thing you can do. Like confidence, I think, has a smell in its own way. That's why I said like laughter, I think, is the fastest way. So that's one thing. The second thing is in terms of attraction, they've done a lot of research in this where they take like people's worn shirts and they have couples smell shirts.
I've heard about this.
You know, you actually go to speed dating events that are based on smell. I think it's called smell dating, actually. And they are very effective. We can tell a lot about someone by if our smells match up. And
you're
so
talking about the natural pheromones,
natural
not the perfume.
Smell. Nope. Okay. They literally, people had to wear, I think, these shirts for 2 days, no deodorant, no soap, no lotions. And they put them in Ziploc bags and then you smell and you pick your partner that you want to go on another little speed date with. Yes. And by the way, this is like so weird. One of the studies I read, I forget which one it was, they added in siblings shirts and people thought their siblings were disgusting.
No way.
Yeah, like they rated people and like across the board people, anyone, they didn't know it was their sibling scent.
Right,
they rated that one as like the lowest, most unattractive scent. So like there's something
such a
to
thing.
It. Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Like there's a lot of research. It's so interesting. So your natural scent, I actually think is the most important. I think it can attract the right person. Now, do I want you to come in like sweaty from the gym? No, but do I love dating at the gym? Yes. Do I highly recommend trying to date in scenarios where your scent will be more prominent? Yeah. Like go on like hike meetups, like go to the beach, you know, meet someone at the pool, like meet someone at the gym, go to dance classes, like Yeah. Like there's something to that. Mm. Like if you're looking for your partner.
That's kind of what people talk about, maybe like around vibe. Like, oh, I just can't explain it, but I just feel so comfortable around this person physically.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah. The other really weird thing is, this is like the weirdest, you're going to be like, what? Okay. So yeah. There was a study. So researchers know that smell is really powerful. So much so that there was a hypothesis, which proved to be true, that we really like to smell people, but it's socially unacceptable to smell each other, right? Yep. They think it's one of the reasons why we get so close to handshake is because like that we get into smelling distance. It's why a lot of cultures hug or cheek kiss is because even bowing, like we're getting closer to their scent, right? When you bow, you're actually getting closer to where their neck is exposed. Okay. So their hypothesis was that if you handshake with someone, in the next 10 seconds, you will touch your own nose because you're trying to smell their hand.
You mean like?
So like we shake hands.
Shake hands.
Your nose will start to itch in like the next 10 seconds or you'll really want to touch your face.
Hmm.
Like I do.
Yeah.
I want to touch my nose very bad.
Right, right.
Do you?
I mean, I'm like actively I'm trying not to actively think about it just for the sake of it. But
so like what they studied is that your nose like kind of tingles.
Yeah.
Because it wants you to bring your hand to your nose so you can kind of smell it.
I guess so. The weirdest. Just naturally, you're just bringing it back, right?
But like watch. So yeah. Like this is the weirdest thing I've ever said on YouTube. But like go to a networking event or a business event and just watch. You will see that people will shake hands and within like 10 to 15 seconds, they inexplicably touch their nose or their face.
Right. Something around it.
Something around it. Because their hypothesis is it's our way of like very subtly being like, are we good? Like, do we have like chemical match? And now that I'm aware of it, it drives me crazy because I don't want to touch my nose.
One thing I do is when I'm at a networking event, let's say, like I have an instinct of grabbing my drink because maybe I don't want to just actively touch my nose.
No, but like that's
this
it.
Is pretty that much is touching it. My nose, right?
100%.
Yeah, that is a for sure thing.
Or like touch your glasses.
Yes.
Like I really want to itch my nose right now. Like it actively itches.
Interesting.
And I wasn't itching before.
And do you think that's just for even...
Oh, this is not dating. This is like...
This is anyone.
Yeah, this is any because their hypothesis in the study is that as humans, we're looking for just chemical matchups. And also, we want to see, are you afraid? Right? Like from a caveman perspective, wouldn't you want to know if someone was with you if they were afraid?
Right.
That would tell you something.
Right.
And so there's a lot more research to be done in this area, but... So natural smell is something. And then the last thing is synthetic smell. So they just studied this. I just put it on my YouTube channel. The most popular scent in the world on humans, so like not just like in a room, is vanilla. So for women and men, I've never smelled a man who smelled like vanilla, but I wear vanilla perfume because of that study.
Well, you weren't wearing that before?
No, because this is a study I've known about. I've been wearing it forever because of that study.
And that's just a neutral thing that allows you to have like trust, likability, all of these combined, or what's the deal
they
there?
They think that food related scents make us happy because food, we like it makes us feel safe. And vanilla is a food related scent, right? Like it is. And so maybe there's something to that. I think there is something to that. Like, you know, realtors will often bake cookies in the oven before they show a house because there's something about walking into a house and smelling freshly baked cookies that makes you feel at home.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And so I think it works. Like I've done all kinds of very casual experiments with food-related scents. I did a ridiculous experiment back in my early days where I read a study that people like, men especially, like food-related scents on women. And this is when I was single. I'm married now. But I thought this was like a hilarious study. And so I popped popcorn in the microwave.
Yeah.
And then I opened the bags and I rubbed the buttery inside of the bag all over my arms and my neck.
And then you went to the gym?
Then I went to a frat party.
Oh.
And I was like dancing with a guy and he was like, dang, you smell good. And I was like, wow, it is flat out butter popcorn that he smells. But he actually commented on it. I didn't do it again because it really is greasy and it makes you break out.
But
it did work. Like literally the guy was like, dang, you smell good. And I was like, it is literally popcorn
That's
butter.
That's so fascinating. And you think it'll work for women as well? Or do you think it's more for men?
I don't think a woman would be like into a guy that smelled like a movie theater.
Right, right.
I think it only goes That's just the
men.
Other way.
Yeah. Like, only men would be full of shit. Yeah.
I would be so open to someone running that experiment. Like,
That's
you know,
so
go out, smell like some popcorn and just like see what happens.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. This is why I was so interested. Like smell is is not something people really think about so much, right? We think more on a visual sense. But this really aligns around the topic around trust, right? Kind of building that trust when you first meet someone. Maybe it's not just around smell, but what are some things that we can do? Maybe we haven't met this person before, or maybe we are trying to sell something to someone or negotiate. And we just want to build that trust, but there's not a lot of time, right? Because I think people can do that through email.
You don't need time.
Talk to me.
Trust is built almost immediately, like in the first few seconds. Okay. And so actually less time is sometimes easier because our instinct, so the research is very clear on this, that we make our first impression within the first few seconds of seeing someone. It's solidified as we start to talk to them, but it's very, very quickly. That's because our brain wants to take shortcuts. And it's also, in the first few seconds, it's hard to lie to someone. And so we're trying to like look and see, like size someone up very, very quickly. So it's good news, I think. It means you only have to worry about the first few seconds, really. And if you're showing up authentically and you're not going to an event that you don't like, it's easier to show those trust signals. The way that I like to think about it is you want to show that you were on the same page as someone, physically on the same page
physically,
as someone.
Physically, okay.
Yes. And so we like people who are engaged fully with us and aligned with us. So that's what I think about is like alignment. So that goes all the way from our toes to our head. So you'll notice like we are angling towards each other.
Yep.
It would be hard if I were sitting like this and talking like this to you.
Yeah, I've had interviews like that.
It feels weird, right?
I just feel like
there's something about it.
Just to align. Yeah,
there is something about it, and I actually it not only disengages you to me, it also disengages me to you. So physically aligning. So as you're talking to someone, seated or standing, video or not, like it drives me crazy when it's people on video with their video camera here and they're typing here and they're like, right? Like I love that like this camera is right here. Like I can align with everyone watching to say like, I respect you. I hope you don't use a lot from like, you know, all the way over there. But so physical alignment, toes, torso, head. Toes, torso, head. It's called fronting, right? So angling, we're on the same railroad tracks. That's the very first thing. And you'd be surprised how often we do it accidentally where people will pull back. You think you do this, but you'd be shocked at how often people will pull their shoulder back. It's called blading.
Is that because they're not comfortable or they want to get out of the situation?
Not comfortable. Don't want to seem too eager. You know, there's that sort of thing of like, hey, what's up?
Guys do that a lot, right? Yeah. More than girls? Okay.
Yeah. And so you'd be surprised how often you will catch yourself blading, pulling your shoulder back or even like, you know, leaning back and angling away. So angling forward, eye contact is the next kind of alignment, right? Right. We want to make eye contact. It doesn't have to be 100%.
Right.
So 100% eye contact is actually an invasive cue, right? Like if someone's like staring you down, it's like very weird.
Right.
So it's 60 to 70% eye contact.
Okay.
Right. So as you're meeting, oh, it's so good to see you. It's okay to look away. It's okay to be like, oh my gosh, this is such a great place.
Sure.
60 to 70% eye contact produces oxytocin, which makes us want to connect and bond.
60 to 70.
And then the next, smiling if you feel authentic. I never want someone to be like smiling when they don't feel like smiling. That's actually a bad cue.
So how do you know if someone is having an inauthentic smile?
So a fake smile doesn't reach all the way up into the upper cheek muscles. So these upper cheek muscles, they pull up your smile. So if I can smile like this, there's no activation out here.
Right.
This is a total fake smile.
You look very uncomfortable, by the way, right now.
Right. It makes everyone uncomfortable if I'm like, hey, good to see you.
Yeah.
Right. Like that is also a pet peeve. If someone walks into a room or hops on a call, hey, yeah, good to see you. It feels bad. I would rather you say, hey, it's nice to see you.
Right.
I would much rather you take away that smile. So if you feel like smiling, great. That's an alignment cue. If you don't, do not fake it till you make it.
Sure.
In that area. You know, someone is actually happy to see you when it reaches all the way up into that upper.
Right. They
face.
Got the curl, curls.
Crow's feet. Only 1 in 10 people can consciously activate those muscles. So when you see them activated, you almost always know that it's real.
Okay.
It's hard to fake that.
Right.
You can do it with practice. Like I can do it because I've practiced it enough, but it took me like a year.
Yeah, and you're an expert. Activated. So most people, you'll know this is the sign. Okay.
And the next one, if you're able to do it, is like vocal alignment. And this is like advanced, right? This is like very advanced. So this is for my people who really want to dial in their communication. So vocal alignment is when you try to match and mirror the voice that you hear, not mimic them, but I'll give you an example. So have you ever seen two girls greet each other where they go, oh my God, it's so good to see you. Hi.
Yeah.
What they're actually doing is vocal alignment. They're actually showing, I love you so much. We're meeting in the same way. like a wavelength.
Okay. But so it's not fake, you're saying?
No.
When you see this, this is just...
Humans do this.
Right.
We do this. So I believe there was a study that looked at Larry King interviews. Hmm. I forgot exactly what it was, but they found that people match the vocal tone, cadence, pitch of the most powerful person in the room.
Got it.
So we are already doing this.
Right.
But I like to bring awareness to it because it's a way that if you're nervous, sometimes you can miss it, right? Mm. Like you're so wrapped up in your own nervousness that you're like, a lot of the times people will hold their breath on their first words. They'll go, hey, good to see you.
Right.
And they've like thrown away that first word. So like you have a much more like calm energy.
Yeah.
Right. So like when I'm talking to you, I bring my vocal tone down. Mm. I speak a little bit more calmly. When I was talking to my girlfriends, I talk much faster, much more.
Are you?
Oh, very much. Okay. So if you go watch an interview with Lisa Bilyeu.
Yeah.
So Lisa Bilyeu is one of my girlfriends. Yeah. I love her. At Impact Theory, you'll notice I talk differently.
It is different then.
I match up because she's talking like this, huge hand gesture. She's like, hey girl, I'm so excited to have you here. And I am too.
Right.
So like I'm trying to respect you by like matching where you're at, because it's your home, it's your interview, right? So I want to match where you're at. And so that's a very advanced way that you can do that.
Got it. Now the reverse, when you're trying to see if someone is trying to, let's say, manipulate you or if someone is lying to you, I'm certainly more on the other side where like I am trying to be more aware of that, but some people are just, they're not there, right? They just kind of miss all these different signals.
Totally.
So what are some of the simple ones that you can look out for that, okay, like this is a pretty obvious signal.
That someone's like, it's a signal of like, I shouldn't trust this person. Is that what we're looking for?
Yeah, more like red flags around that.
Right. So when we're looking for, I shouldn't trust this person, what you're looking for is mismatches.
Hmm.
So when someone is congruent, their words match their tone, match their body, like it's all in alignment. You're like, yes. When you see mismatches, that's when they're like, what? Like what's happening? So this could happen in a lot of different ways. So the very most obvious way is facial expressions to words.
Okay.
So if someone says, I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah.
And they look so unhappy. Mismatch.
Right.
So, okay. In that sense, I wouldn't think that they're a con man, but I would think, oh, they're having a hard day and they're trying for me, you know, right? Like I was like, okay, I'm going to try to make it easy on them because they're not having a good time.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
So someone saying they're happy and not being happy is the first big one. The other one that I look out for a lot is contempt. So contempt is a one-sided mouth raise. So one.
Yep.
We tend to think of it as like a smirk. Kind of partial happiness, but actually it's like quite a negative micro expression. It means like disdain or superiority.
Mm.
So people will often do it when they're like, right.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned this in the last one where you were able to predict like a crazy amount of chances that they would be divorced, right? Just from that one expression.
John Gottman can predict with 93.6% accuracy if a couple will get divorced by looking for contempt.
That's wild.
So that's a mismatch. Someone saying, yes, I love her. Right? Like that is, that's a mismatch. I would want to dig deeper on that. Usually it doesn't happen in that obvious of a way. Usually it's like you're in a meeting and you share an idea and someone goes,
yeah, you got to pay attention, right? To see those.
That's when I'm like, like that idea did not resonate. Then that doesn't mean the idea is bad. It means maybe I have to explain it a different way. Maybe they have a question. Maybe they have self-hate. Like you don't always know why the contempt is there, but it's a mismatch of this should be a creative brainstorm session. And for some reason you're showing disdain, superiority, disrespect. So contempt is a mismatch. I like to look for more subtle ones. Are mismatches in hand gestures or mismatches in body language gestures. So for example, if in this culture, in American culture, in Western cultures, this means yes, up and down nod means yes, a horizontal nod means no. It's different in India, Pakistan, and Bulgaria.
Right, India is this is yes.
Yeah, exactly, could be either. Yeah. So in Western cultures, so if someone says, you know, I really like her, and they're shaking their head no, that's a little bit of an odd mismatch, right? Like,
do people do that though? Without, they just don't think about it, right?
Oh yeah,
but it just
all the time because someone's like, so you say, hey, what do you think of the new girl?
Well,
yeah, she's great, right? Because they're like, what do I say? What do I say? What do I say? What do I say? Right? Now you have to be careful because some people use body language gestures as what are called punctuators. Punctuators, like there's a famous interview, I forget who it is, either like Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon, where they do this all the time. Like they're constantly shaking their head no. So for them, that's just how they emphasize their words. Mm. That wouldn't, but if someone all of a sudden is like, you know, she's great.
Right.
She's great. Right, with like a lip purse, which is like a withholding gesture.
Yeah.
That's like a mismatch.
Yeah.
Right, like that's something's not right there. Or liars are very bad with matching their hand gestures to their words. In our lab, we studied liars. I'm fascinated by deceivers because I think it's so interesting what happens to our body in guilt, which is a little bit different than fear. Mm. So liars have a really hard time with tense. So if something true happened in the past, I use past tense. Oh, what did you do on the night of the incident?
Right.
Well, I went to my girlfriend's house. We watched a movie. We brushed our teeth. We had a little snack. We went to bed. All past. A liar didn't really happen, and they rehearse parts of it. And so they'll mess up their tenses. What happened the night of the incident? I went over to my girlfriend's house, and we're watching a movie. And we realize we have to brush our teeth. So I brush my teeth. Like the tenses are not right.
Right, because he's actively thinking about it. Okay,
and they're rehearsing and like in their mind, it's present.
Interesting.
Right, so they mess up tenses and they also mess up gestures. So for example, it's really hard to lie with our gestures. So if I were to say, okay, let's do an experiment. So will you please hold up the number 3, but say 4?
4.
Horrible, right?
Yeah.
4, tough. Just try it. 4.
Yeah, my eyes also just went that way for a little bit. I don't know if you saw it.
So that would probably be like, that's you're working really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard to do that. So if I say I have a big idea, very hard. Mm. Like my brain does not like it. And so liars, their gestures are often true.
Huh.
So like you'll see like leaks in mismatches in their gestures or no hand gestures at all.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
You'll often see like they'll like grip their hands because they don't want to give themselves away.
And the more you know this person and the patterns of how they respond or act, yeah. the easier that it is to be able to tell that, right?
Yes. Yeah, so like in chapter 6, I talk about how to spot a bad guy, right? Like how to spot a bad guy or a bad girl, whatever, which is knowing, understanding their patterns, their baselines, and also understanding your own patterns and baselines.
Mm.
So this is not just for others. Like I think it's a fundamental life skill that everyone should know what they do when they lie. Not to be better liars, but to catch yourself when you feel like you're lying.
Right.
Like I know what my tells are, right? And so in the book, very easy, I can go through the exercise. You turn on your video camera. You share what you had for breakfast yesterday. Tell me your most embarrassing story. Make up an embarrassing story and try to convince me it's true. Okay, so that's what you record. That's how you recall what you had for breakfast yesterday. Whatever you're doing when you recall, looking up to the left, touching your face, that's your recall truth behaviors.
Right.
Your most embarrassing story are your recall nervous behaviors. What you do when you're recalling something that made you feel really nervous to differentiate nervousness and guilt.
Yeah.
And then your fake embarrassing story is what you do when you're pretending.
Got it.
Okay, so like that's a very quick exercise that helps you identify. I know what my tells are. Like I know what I do when I lie.
What are your tells?
I'm not going to tell you. Are you crazy? That is private information. Don't tell anyone your tells. Right?
Your husband's not watching.
Yeah, don't tell anyone your tells.
Yeah.
But you know what's most helpful is when I catch myself in self-deception. Like I have been with people and they'll ask me questions and I'm like, oh my gosh, I am lying. Like it's been so helpful to me
because
I catch myself when I'm lying to myself about things.
That's super interesting.
And so like, that's why I think it's a really helpful skill is like, I think we actually lie to ourselves far more than we lie to anyone else.
For sure.
Far more.
The inner voice in our heads, right? Yeah. And it could be even limiting beliefs. I would imagine people that tell themselves that they should not earn certain money or deserve this kind of person. We don't even realize it. And maybe there are gestures that we can be more aware of to tell that stuff.
You'll see, like you'll do your guilt gestures when talking about certain things about yourself. Or there are certain people that you notice you use a lot of those tells with that person. And you're like, well, I was like, why? And I realized like they kind of make me lie a little bit. Like
to downplay.
Yeah, or I know certain things about them that I'm afraid to say. And so I'm enabling bad behavior.
because you don't think they'll be happy for you?
No, no. Like I have someone who has their own toxic patterns. This is the person who I realized with. And I was enabling that bad behavior by not saying anything, right? So like if you have a toxic person in your life or a difficult person, you can tiptoe around the issues, the elephants in the room.
Yeah.
And I realized like I was doing it a lot around them where I was like trying to be like extra careful because I was worried that if I said something, I'd offend them.
Because
I don't want to tell them the truth.
Sure.
And that, I was like, I don't want this relationship. Mm. It was a really like amazing moment personally because I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Why am I dancing around truth around this person? Like it's not serving me. It is making me nervous. It is making me lie. I pride myself in not being a liar. And so it made me really step back from that relationship because I was like, I don't want to do this around them. And I didn't realize how often I was dancing around things.
That's so fascinating. So all of these gestures that we're just not even realizing, it can not only help us to see if someone is perhaps lying or not being truthful, but we can also realize who are the people in our lives that we're doing this to ourselves to.
Yeah, and it's not just gestures, by the way. A lot of it can be vocal. So for example, one of the most common lying red flags, that which this is one of mine, and I actually work on it a lot because I also do it when I'm nervous. So is the question inflection used on a statement? So the question inflection is when you go up at the end of your sentence, like you're asking a question.
Like every Canadian. Basically.
But it's actually a statement. Yes, New Zealanders and Canadians do this.
Yeah,
yes.
We do this a lot.
And I think that's actually one of the reasons. So there's research on this.
Yeah.
Why we sometimes research, this is not my opinion, research when we look at cultures that use the question inflection are typically seen as less competent. I think it's because they're literally their accent is questioning.
That's so true. Like, Canadians are too nice,
too
right?
Nice. Exactly. And so like sometimes Canadians will question their own name. My name is Vanessa.
Yeah.
Right. Which is an immediate like dip in confidence. So vocal tone is a huge cue. It's not just gestures. So for example, people will often ask the lie. So one of the things we did in our lab is we had people record two truths and a lie.
Okay.
For us. So that's a very fun game. You deliver two truths and one lie, and we try to guess which is the lie. And people often asked their lie. So they would say, for me, can you guess which one is the lie? I live in Austin, Texas. I love dogs. I love cilantro.
Third.
Right? Okay.
Third
so
one.
I made it obvious for you, but people will often ask it because they're asking, do you believe me? So it's not just gestures. It's vocal tone. It's cadence changes, tense changes.
Wow. And someone that's like at an advanced level, they'll know that the other person is thinking that. And yeah, you got to use those powers to good use,
I mean,
guys.
Look, like I have a whole section of the book of like, use these powers for good, not evil.
Right.
Because they can be used for evil. They can. People do. I mean, you know, how we wield our influence is the choice we have to make. And so I had a real difficult, kind of like a existential crisis writing my last book because I was worried. I was like, what if people use this to be manipulative? And the truth is they could. And so I try to give as many positive examples as possible. I also think that people who use cues in a manipulative way with bad intention, they will eventually be caught.
Yeah.
We cannot control our scent. We cannot control every cue. We cannot control our blink rate. We cannot control our pupil dilation. We cannot control nasal wing flare. We cannot control a lot of cues. And so I think that bad actors will eventually be caught because if you have bad intention, that's all we're looking for is, do you have good intention towards me? And so it only lasts for so long.
For
that's
sure.
That's at least what I tell myself as I was writing the book. I was like,
Well, I would imagine the far majority of the work that you're putting out would allow people to tell more easily those people that are being more manipulative or using it in a negative light.
This
so I 100% think that's the case.
Yeah.
Final kind of point around this idea of feeling guilty or feeling certain ways when we're with others.
Yeah.
One thing that I suffer with, I don't know if this is something for you, but not so much anymore, but I know a lot of people are going through this, which is imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Whether they achieve a certain amount of success or maybe they're not and they're still not thinking that they're worthy of it or having these limiting beliefs around it. What are some ways that we can improve our self-talk, right? Not the way we communicate with others, but ourselves to help us feel more comfortable with, you know, being interesting, right, around others and not being too humble or too down on ourselves where we don't even get the attention that we deserve for the work that we're doing.
Well, first of all, I think that if you feel imposter syndrome, It means you're doing something right. And what I mean by that is people who are doing big things, who are pushing their boundaries, who are stepping outside of their comfort zone, almost always feel imposter syndrome. So I would say, one, it means you're probably pushing yourself, right? Like, you wouldn't feel imposter syndrome if you were in a safe place.
Right.
And so that means, like, maybe you're reaching. Good. Right? Like, maybe you're up-leveling. Great. Maybe you're out of your comfort zone. Okay. Fun things happen outside of our comfort zone. So that's the first reframe, is like, at least you're feeling something that is challenging. Like, at least sure. you're not so safe and hiding. I think sometimes the opposite of feeling imposter syndrome could be hiding. Of course, another opposite is confidence, which I would prefer. But I think it means like you're doing something big and good, right? And so like, I think that's a good thing. So that should be commended. So if you feel it, it means all right. Like, learning is around the corner. Mm. Like, that's a good thing. And so that's the first reframe, is like, it doesn't mean you're doing something wrong.
Okay.
I think a lot of people feel like, oh my God, I feel imposter syndrome. I'm wrong. I'm doing something wrong. I'm not in the right place. No, it means you're doing something right. That's the first thing. The second thing is, the only way I have a lot of imposter syndrome and a lot of awkwardness, I call myself a recovering awkward person. The only way I'm able to get out of that, like out of my head, out of feeling that way, especially in interactions or even like doing interviews or YouTube videos, is this study. This is a study that changed my life.
Okay.
Let's dig in.
So I think imposter syndrome comes from when we're trying to impress people. We're trying to be smart. We're trying to be likable. We're trying to be funny, right? It happens when we're trying to be something and have people think a certain way about us. Right. Successful, smart, yeah. impressive. That is a lot of pressure. It's almost impossible to not feel that way when we're trying to have someone think that we're amazing, right? Such that we don't feel amazing. It's too much pressure. So it's a different paradigm to think about. So this is a research study that looked at popular kids.
Okay, like high school or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
The original connectors, uh-huh. right? So they studied thousands of high school students across a variety of high schools, and they wanted to look for patterns of popularity. Why were certain kids popular in these schools and in grades, in each grade, in each school? And they had hypotheses. They thought, well, maybe they're the smartest. They have the highest GPA. Maybe they're the most athletic. They're quarterback or whatever, right? Head cheerleader. Are they the most athletic? Are they the funniest? Are they the tallest? Are they the richest? They looked at all these things that we often think of for being likable, popular, impressive, sure. successful. None of those were patterns.
None of those.
No, there were kids who were popular because they're athletic, but that was not the pattern for all the kids.
Yep.
There was one single big pattern for all the popular kids across all the schools.
Funny?
Nope. And wouldn't it be horrible if it was funny? How much pressure do you have to know that you have to be funny at all times, right?
I know. Yes. Okay. Did we say looks?
Not looks.
Not
that
looks.
Was a big hypothesis, not looks.
That was.
Not
attractiveness. That's what I thought it would be. Okay, those were my
And there
guesses.
Were popular kids that were attractive.
Right.
But that wasn't, not wasn't every popular pattern. Kid was attractive.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I was not popular, so this is definitely not. Yeah, I'm not like,
like,
what am I? No, I'm having to guess very far away from.
What I was saying, why do you think I read this study like with bated breath? I was like, what is
this? You said it changed your lives. I was like, yeah, it would have.
I wish I read this in high school, actually, but I didn't. It wasn't out then.
No, I feel you.
So the pattern was, the popular kids had the longest list of other kids that they liked. That one of the things they asked every kid was list. All the kids in your school that you like. And the popular kids had the longest list. In other words, they were not going around being the funniest, the smartest, the most impressive. All they were doing was thinking of all the ways they could like people more.
Super interesting. How to win friends and influence people, basically.
The funny thing is, like, he never put it quite that succinctly, Dale Carnegie. Like, he never said, like, forget being impressive. In fact, that was not the message of his book. He often said, like, tell stories, be impressive. And that's hard.
Right.
Like, some Dale Carnegie's advice is hard.
It's pretty hard, yeah.
Right, or like, be interested. That's part of it. But it's literally just trying to like the person you're with.
That's
forget it. About impressing them. Forget about being funny. Forget about mentioning all your cool things. No. It's literally just, how can I like you more? That is actually the key to likability. And so I think that is the only way I was able to get out of my imposter syndrome, is it took all the pressure off of having to be great.
That's so interesting. We all just want to be loved.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
And like,
to
I,
be loved.
I like you.
Yeah.
That phrase, that feeling is the most powerful feeling in the world.
Yeah.
If you share, I like you with someone else, you give them permission to be themselves. You are saying, I like you just as you are. Mm. You are worthy and you are valued. That is the greatest gift you can give someone. That's all we want, interaction. The other person does not want to hear how amazing you are. Maybe they want to laugh, but like, that's not why they're there. All they want to do is, do you like me? Do you like me? Do you like me? Do you like me? Right. Do you like me? Do you like me? And so the sooner you can find a reason to like them and share that you like them, the more likable you are.
Right. And it's so funny because you would always think that the more successful someone is or the more money someone has, sometimes it's even the extreme case. Like those people need way more validation. And when I think about like, how do you surround yourself with people that are way more successful than you, is like, it is kind of your advice, right? It's just make them feel heard. You make them feel important.
And find authentic reasons to like them. Like think about the people you like most. They're often like not the richest or the prettiest or the funniest. You just genuinely like them for who they are. There's a reason for that, right? Like, so I think that the imposter syndrome is like, forget trying to even show someone you're great or be great. It just takes that whole paradigm and throws it out the window.
That's so interesting. Get out of your head and more into your heart at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I think that's a powerful way, Vanessa, to close this off in a warm way, but also
competent way
with research and studies. I just want to ask, when is the next book coming out? Because we're all waiting at this point, right?
I know. So I just had a baby. So I think of my work as I have a research year, a writing year, and a launch year. That's typically how I think of it. So right now I'm in research year. So I'm researching. And so my next book is going to be, I have Cues, Captivate. It will be another C word.
Okay.
It will be. No,
any hints or any?
Nope. Rough? It'll be another C word. You can guess if you want.
Okay. Well, we'll have to go around four.
So I'm researching right now, kind of my big idea for the book. It requires some research. And so, yes, I'm researching. So maybe 2 years, maybe 2 years. 3.
2 years. Well, some of you might be listening to this when it's out, right?
You never know.
So
yes.
Whatever it might be.
Go check it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And where else can people find you online?
So my books are on Audible. If you like listening, I read Cues and Captivate. I had so much fun with the vocal power on those books.
Yeah, yeah. It's not AI read. It's
me. It's legit me.
It's a real person.
Really me.
We promise. Yes.
So it's really me, painfully recorded over many, many days. And also my books are on Amazon. And then of course, sciencepeople.com is where we have all of our free trainings. So I have a bunch of audio trainings and video trainings on likability. I also have one on how to deal with difficult people. Piece of today resonated with you. We didn't get to dive into it.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking about a lot these days.
Beautiful. All right. Round 3 complete.
Woo-hoo!
Thanks so much for checking out, guys.
Bye.
Check it out.